Hi, everybody. It is Friday, February 7th, 2025, and our friend Scott Rader is back with us. Welcome back, Scott.
Thanks, Ram.
Let's get started with Donald Trump and his position and his solution for the conflict in the Middle East. Many people are confused about what he was talking about. What's your understanding of that?
I'm right up there with them. I mean, my understanding is that he didn't pre-clear this with anybody. And I think there was a reason for that. You know, he has surrounded himself with some of the most pro-Israel, pro-Zionist Americans possibly. And if he had done the normal staff coordination processes, it would have leaked this to Benjamin Netanyahu in advance. The Israelis would have been given advanced copies. People would have met on the side and to pre-brief the Israelis. Apparently, Trump didn't tell anybody that this was happening, including Netanyahu, and took him by surprise. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why would that be the case? And I think the answer is that he was putting Netanyahu in his place and taking Israel off the playing board. Israel doesn't, according to Trump's plan, Israel's not a player. The Israeli army won't be involved. Israeli security won't be involved. Israel's not going to be in. And I mean, everything that Israel thought was going to happen with Gaza isn't happening under Trump's plan. So you have to ask yourself why that would be. Why would this president, who has said he's a great friend of Israel, who has surrounded himself with Zionists and such, make a decision to humiliate Benjamin Netanyahu in front of the world stage and take Israel off the playing board? And I think it relates to a statement that he made, you know, after his first term, where someone talked about Middle East peace process, and he said, "Look, there's two players here, but one of them doesn't want peace, and that is Israel." So he knows that Israel is the problem. He knows that Benjamin Netanyahu is the problem also. That's why he reposted Jeffrey Sachs's condemnation of Benjamin Netanyahu. Why would Trump do that if he was, you know, the compliant puppet of Netanyahu? Because he's not. He doesn't like Netanyahu. He recognizes that Netanyahu is the problem, not the solution. And so he did this. I mean, that's the only way to read this. There's no other way to read this than that. But then we can look at what he put on the table. It's so absurd, outrageous, and unrealistic that it's just not going to happen. Why would he do that? Why would Donald Trump make that his opening gambit? Because that's how Donald Trump always operates. I'm not saying it's always successful. I think he's going to find out that it isn't going to work in with the Russians. But on this seat, let me ask you, I mean, it's a rhetorical question, but if Donald Trump had gone back to business as usual, that is, leaning heavy towards Israel for a solution, that means there would never be a solution. Just more death and destruction, endless fighting. For the Palestinians, no hope whatsoever. For the Arab world, continued humiliation. And so he had to do something different. What he put on the table was completely different. It's unlike any proposal that's ever been put out there before. But it's not a solution. It's a proposal, meaning that he has swept the board clear. Now he's put his proposition on the table. And I think to get a seat at the table, you have to say more than no. I think to get a seat at the table, you have to say no, but here's an alternative. Here's a counter offer. And I think that's what's going on here. I think Trump is playing, you know, a game that's so unlike normal statesmanship, so unlike, you know, normal diplomacy, that people are just totally, you know, bent out of whack over this. I don't take what he said literally. I don't read into anything he said, because none of that's going to happen. Literally none of it can happen. I view this as an opening proposition in order to get people to come in and say, okay, how do we solve this? You see, because you can't rely on the past tools. The past tools didn't work. Anybody wants to sit here and make a case that Trump should have just continued doing what everybody's been doing for 40 or 50 years, then you're saying you really don't care about the Palestinian people. I know people are going to say, well, Trump doesn't. He didn't, you know, he's taking their, he's not taking anything, people. Stop. He's not taking anything. The United States doesn't own Gaza. We're not putting troops on the ground. We're not driving 1.9 million people out. It isn't going to happen. None of that's going to happen. That's just Trump's opening game. And again, you have to, you know, rely on, you know, people who assess what others do for a living. Look for patterns of life, patterns of behavior. And Trump's past patterns of behavior, I think, are a good judge of what he's up to. Go back and look at North Korea and what he did with North Korea in his first term. Fire and fury, threatening nuclear war. Kim Jong-un, if you sneeze, if you dare do this, I'm going to blow you off the face of the earth. Boom. 6 months later, he's meeting with the guy. Three meetings, including one at the demilitarized zone, crossing over into North Korea to shake the guy's hand. I don't think anybody who heard Donald Trump speak at the United Nations said, that's how this ends. And I can almost guarantee you that how this ends isn't going to be anything like the statement made by Donald Trump in the White House. It's just an opening gambit. It's the way Trump does business.
And it doesn't seem that he's comfortable with Israel continuing the attack on Gazans, because we know that right now we are in the first phase of the ceasefire between Israelis and Gazans. How about the second and third? How do you feel about those process?
I don't feel anything about them. You know, I think we're in a wait and see. I don't think Israel was ever serious about this. This is one of the reasons why Donald Trump did what he did, to create a new paradigm, because Israel was never serious about this ceasefire. And Donald Trump believes that if you just continue to do business as normal, the ceasefire will be violated and Israel will be back at war in Gaza and America will be stuck in the middle. So we'll see what happens. I think Trump is putting pressure on Israel to stay the course. Whether it's successful or not, we'll see. Israel has a long history of undermining American foreign policy prerogatives, because Israel only cares about Israel. Israel's not a friend of America. I just want to remind people of that. I come from the day and age in the Cold War where I remember what Jonathan Pollard did to the United States of America. Under the Israeli intelligence officer, he stole the crown jewels, SIGINT. And no, back in the Cold War, I want to remind people, just so they say, well, this isn't a big deal. Really? We had airplanes flying missions inside the Soviet Union, along the periphery of the Soviet Union, that got shot down. Top secret missions where we lost scores of people, dead Americans, giving their lives to gather intelligence that the National Command Authority said was essential for our national security. You can go back and rewrite history. I don't give a flying you know what. At the time, these were heroes doing dangerous missions, and they gave their lives to gather the intelligence that went into the book that Jonathan Pollard stole and gave to the Israelis, who turned around and gave it to the Soviets so they could get favorable immigration status for the Russian Jews. Israel is not a friend of America. Never has been, never will be. Israel cares only about Israel. Ask the survivors of the USS Liberty. Ask the FBI today, you know, when they're not harassing Americans. You know, they should be protecting us from the espionage of Israel. Who's the greatest intelligence threat to the United States of America? It's not Russia. It's not China. Who is the most aggressive collector of intelligence against the American target? Israel. Israel is not our friend at all, not even close. Israel uses America like a parasite uses its host. That's it. So, and I think Trump has broken the code. Trump understands this. He understands that about Netanyahu. But, you know, in parasitical relationships that are advanced, you can't just strip the parasite away or kill yourself. The parasite has invaded the host so much that you can't remove the parasite without killing yourself. So you have to gradually wean yourself from them. Maybe that's the direction he's going. I don't know. But there are enough of us who remember what Israel is and what Israel has always been. And it's not a friend of America.
How, in your opinion, how does Donald Trump see Netanyahu and his position in Israel?
I don't know.
That
I
mean, would bring so much things in his calculation in terms of how he's gonna deal with Netanyahu.
He knows Netanyahu is a liar. He knows Netanyahu has lied to him. And if you read into the post that he put out with Jeffrey Sachs, he knows that Netanyahu has set America up to get involved in Israel's wars, to have America do the fighting for Israel. So Trump appears to be all-knowing about this, aware of this. What he does, I don't know. I mean, there was a movie called Inside the, you know, John Malkovich's Brain. Maybe we need to make a movie about Inside Trump's Brain and speculate. If anybody can sit here and say they know for certain what's going on inside Trump's brain, God bless them. I certainly don't know what's going on. I can speculate. I can take a look at, you know, past patterns of behavior. That's what an analyst does. I can look at, was it 15 seasons of The Apprentice to watch how he operates, to watch his team building processes, how he criticizes people, what he looks for in leadership. These are all tells. So you can look at that and get an idea of who he is. You can look at his performance, as president prior, and then you can sort of anticipate actions. But the idea that I have any idea what's going on inside his brain, I don't. And I pretty much can say probably maybe nobody does. And that's the way Trump apparently wants it. But I don't think he likes Netanyahu. I think he despises Netanyahu. Otherwise, why did he do what he did? Netanyahu is white-knuckling it through that presentation. You saw his hands on the podium. He was sitting there going, what the hell am I listening to? What is he saying? Why is he? It was humiliating. Humiliating for the Israeli prime minister. And that seems to be Trump's thing. Bring him in, pomp and circumstances, and then set him straight in front of the world. Why did Trump do that? Only Donald Trump knows.
I think in terms of for example, with the situation in Lebanon right now, here is a tremendous opportunity for Donald Trump to find out a solution for the conflict. Because right now in Lebanon, we have some sort of agreement between Hezbollah and the government in Lebanon. They're getting along with each other. And Houthis are not attacking Israel. These people in Gaza are going to their homes, to the northern part of Gaza. We know that what is the situation there. And it seems to me, as you mentioned, Donald Trump doesn't want Israel to attack attack on Gazans. But the situation in the West Bank, how can we bring the puzzle, the piece of the West Bank into the puzzle? How can we interpret what's going on in the West Bank and to understand the situation, the future of Gaza?
I just want to make one observation. Hezbollah isn't getting along with the Lebanese government. Hezbollah is the Lebanese government. It's one of the major parties of the Lebanese government. So it's not about Hezbollah getting along. Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government and has to be treated as such. You don't get along with yourself. So there's that. And I would also point out that Israel continues to occupy illegally significant portions of southern Lebanon. And Hezbollah is a resistance movement that has great credibility inside Lebanon because it is the liberator of Lebanon from Israeli occupation. To prove that in the past. And if Israel thinks that they're going to create a situation where internal domestic politics in Lebanon hampers Hezbollah's ability to oppose them, they've read the cards wrong. All of Lebanon knows what Hezbollah is. And all of Lebanon respects what Hezbollah does. What Hezbollah does is protect Lebanese soil from illegal Israeli occupation. So that's a big problem that Trump has to face right now. If he wants to sustain this peace, he needs to get Israeli troops out of southern Lebanon. And so far, I haven't heard him say anything to that nature. He has to keep the peace in Gaza because if it reignites, the Houthi will continue to shell. The Houthi made it clear they don't give a damn about anything the West does. They've linked their operations to the situation in Gaza. If there's a reversal there, I think you'll see the Houthi re-engage. West Bank. Trump doesn't care about the West Bank. Never did. Go back and take a look at the Abrahams Accords and look at how the West Bank was treated, breaking up into Bantu land, shrinking it down to nothing. Nothing's changed. And Trump has basically given a green light to Israeli settlements on the West Bank. So the West Bank doesn't factor. The only way to make the West Bank factor is for the Palestinians who live there to do what Hamas did in Gaza. and to rise up and make themselves counted. I'm talking about, I'm not talking about the sporadic resistance that's taking place. I'm talking about a wholesale uprising, launch an attack, take an Israeli city, kill as many Israelis as possible, grab as many as you can, bring them back, and dare the Israelis to come in like Hamas did. If you don't do that, you're just going to be slaughtered. And that's what's happening right now, is the United States has turned its back on these. Everybody's turned their back on these people. Even the Palestinians have turned their backs on the people. Israel gets away with what it does in the West Bank because of Abu Mazen, Mohammed Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, who every day that he continues to rule as the president of the Palestinian Authority only proves that a significant percentage of the Palestinians are self-hating Palestinians who don't care about a Palestinian homeland, but care more about the money that Israel and the United States puts into their pockets and their sacrifice in the West Bank. And Israel will continue to aggressively move on the West Bank, and the United States won't do anything to stop it. The only way you get the United States to intervene is if you make a problem so big that the United States can't ignore it. Ooh, like Gaza. But right now, what's going on in the West Bank, it hasn't captured the world's attention. The world isn't sitting there. You know, Israel's doing horrible things right now, tearing up civilian infrastructure, killing families, the whole works. World's ignoring it. You don't see the United Nations going batshit crazy over the West Bank. They should, but they're not. Where are the demonstrators in the streets? Here in the United States. Man, they were there for Gaza, not there for the West Bank. Nobody cares. So if nobody cares, then it's not a problem. And Trump's not going to do anything to deal with it.
How did you find the reaction coming out of Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Arab states like Jordan and Egypt, which Donald Trump was talking about them because he said that he's going to send these people to these two countries?
Well, they said no. But now, ask yourself, are they part of the problem or the solution now? If you say no, you're not part of the solution. So they become part of the problem. So they just define themselves as part of the problem. And Donald Trump, you know, is a very, he has thin skin. He holds a grudge. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, they basically proved in Donald Trump's mind what everybody knew, that none of them have a solution. It's amazing the Arabia can sit there and say, we won't normalize relations with Israel until which time there's a Palestinian state and its capital is in East Jerusalem. How do we get from here to there, pal? They don't have a clue because they don't want it to happen. Saudi Arabia doesn't want Palestine. Jordan doesn't want Palestine. Egypt doesn't want Palestine. None of the Gulf Arab states want Palestine. If they did want it, we'd have a Palestine today. They don't want it. They're just playing lip service because the genocide that Israel carried out was so outrageous that the people of the streets are, it can't be ignored. So the governments are placating them with throwaway statements. But Donald Trump's called out their hypocrisy because none of them have a solution. All they can do is say no. None of them can say, no, why don't we try this instead? None of them have a solution. And so, you know, Donald Trump and his, you know, evil genius ways has exposed the hypocrisy of the entire Arab world, except for the Shia Arabs who fight on behalf of Hamas in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Yemen, and then of course the Iranians.
Scott, why do they feel this way? I'm talking about the Arab states. Is that because of the nature of these people, the sort of living they have against the government, against any sort of authority above them? Because we have to understand why these Arab states are not supporting people in Gaza. Is that something related to the society in Gaza, to the way that they're living their lives? Because they feel that would threaten their sort of government, the sort of authority in their countries, or it's something beyond that?
I think basically it comes down to the fact that the United States has compromised the leadership of all the Arab world. And I mean, Egypt, why doesn't, you know, what does Sisi believe in? the billions of dollars of American aid flowing to Egypt. You know, when Trump shut down foreign aid, Egypt was the exception. Why? Because the Egyptian aid is tied to Israeli aid by law. And if you cut the Egyptian aid, you got to cut the Israeli aid. And Egypt's not going to do anything to lose that money. That's how this corrupt man Sisi stays in power. American money buying off people. The king of Jordan. We know he's not Jordanian. He's a Hashemite, a Saudi. His family was imposed on the people of Jordan, you know, in the aftermath of World War I. In the same way that a Hashemite was imposed on Syria for a small period of time and imposed on Iraq. In Iraq, it went bad for them. They ended up dragging his body through the streets. That's the fate of the king of Jordan if he's not careful. And the way he stays in power is to keep his Western masters happy. And the way you keep them happy is you go along with the Israeli. There won't be a Palestine. They don't want a Palestine because a Palestine, it's not about, you know, what a Palestine would represent to them in terms of a threat. It's because it upsets a balance in the Middle East that is favorable to the economic and political elites of Israel's neighbors. You know, if you redefine relationships in the Middle East, then these power structures get redefined and the people that are in power may not be in power anymore. And people that are in power always want to stay in power. So I think the concept of Palestine is threatening because it threatens to bring an end to this period of instability that the United States, Great Britain, and others have used to impose their will on regional leaders.
The other surprising issue that Donald Trump was talking about was the nuclear deal between the United States and Iran, which was, you look at Netanyahu and you see how he doesn't seem that much comfortable with what Donald Trump was talking about. And this is the first time he's talking directly about the issue. And he said that I want to talk with Iranians. And one of the reporters said that what would be your plan? Iran is now weaker than before in terms of Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, and all of that. He said, I appreciate what you're talking about, but they're stronger. And then he went and talked about negotiations with Iran. And considering all of that, sitting next to Netanyahu talking about these things, that was amazing to see, and the reaction from Netanyahu. How did you find that part of his argument?
I've been saying this forever, Nemo. I've been saying it on your show. I've said it from day one. Go back to, pull up your archives. I've said Iran's direction is not towards conflict with Israel. Iran doesn't want a conflict with Israel. Iran is strategically oriented in different directions. And this was even under Raisi. But then Raisi died and was replaced by I can't pronounce his name, the new Iranian Pezeshkian. President. Yeah. Yes. And who openly campaigned on wanting to have better relations with the West. And I said, that's the reality. All these people are saying Iran's going to blow Israel off the face of the map. True promise. I said, no. I mean, they could. They have the military capacity to do so. But Iran's not, that's not the direction the Iranian leadership wants to take Iran. Iran is a member of BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Eurasian Economic Union. Iran is looking for stability, not instability, and war never brings stability. It only brings instability. Iran's looking for economic engagement, not military engagement. And so Iran has a completely different approach to problem solving that is conducive to what Donald Trump is seeking to do, which is a better deal. Remember, he got out of the JCPOA not to bomb Iran. That's why Israel wanted him to get out of the JCPOA. Netanyahu has always been a bombing. Why did Trump pick those Jeffrey Sachs clips? What did Sachs say? That Netanyahu had got us involved in all of the wars in the Middle East. That means Trump is saying, yeah, that's what Netanyahu, he knows the game Netanyahu is playing. Netanyahu is one of the reasons why Trump pulled out of the JCPOA, based upon the Israeli intelligence that, you know, the Mossad got raiding that little document place, you know, the wonderful little story they told about capturing documents that when they published them, it appeared that these are the same documents that they released back in 2004. Got to do a better job, Israel. You can't release them twice, but they did, which means the whole thing is a lie, a setup. Trump knows this, and he knows that Israel's trying to get him involved in a war. He knows what Netanyahu's agenda is. So once again, he's stuck it to Netanyahu. Now, this isn't a surprise. Trump has been campaigning on this constantly. Back in September, he talked about, you know, the fact that he wants to lift sanctions on Iran, that he doesn't want regime change, that, you know, but he is worried about Iran's nuclear program. So I think Trump is in a position today to try and get a better deal. And I think that's the direction this is heading, towards negotiation. Now, he is running into pushback from Iran, who doesn't like the way Trump opens up, you know, maximum pressure and all this. Iranians are like, no, we're not playing that game. But I think eventually the Iranians are going to come around to the fact that that's just posturing, and that the sooner you can get to the table with Donald Trump, the better, because he wants to make a deal. And if there's a deal out there that could be made that gives Iran what it wants and gives Trump what it wants, then I think that's the direction that we'll be heading, and Israel doesn't like that. Israel doesn't like that direction at all. Because remember, at the end of the day, the biggest threat to Israel isn't an Iranian nuclear weapon. Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon. They could, but they don't have one. The biggest threat is Iran's ballistic missiles, and Iran's not giving those missiles up. That is their deterrence. And I think Trump understands that too, that Iran's not giving up its missiles. So Trump's going to make a go at, that's one of the things that complicated negotiations in the past during the Biden administration, is trying to make linkage between ballistic missiles and the nuclear program. If Trump comes in with a clean agenda saying it's only about nuclear, I think there's a deal there to be had.
I think on the part of Donald Trump, he understands that if he gets along with Netanyahu and his sort of plan, there has to be endless war in the Middle East. No other solution, because they don't seem to have any sort of solution but continuous conflict and war in the Middle East. And this is where Donald Trump doesn't agree with Netanyahu. And
there's nowhere that Trump agrees with Netanyahu. Let's understand that. Donald Trump hates Benjamin Netanyahu. Doesn't like him. There's no agreement between the two. It's all a game. But one of the main reasons is that Netanyahu's trying to get America into wars that Trump says we're not going to fight anymore. So yeah, there's this, that's a major, you know, roadblock between the two. And Trump doesn't deal with these problems the way that, you know, most diplomats or statesmen would. He's very direct and he's very blunt, and he doesn't give a damn about protocol. We saw that he made a statement in front of the Israeli prime minister, two major commitments to policy directions that weren't pre-cleared with the Israelis. Thrown out, and Netanyahu was just sitting there looking confused. And the other thing you have to remember is that Trump knows that Netanyahu conspired against him. Especially in this election, that the Israelis were pushing really hard for Kamala Harris, really hard for Kamala Harris. They were pushing for Joe Biden before that. Trump is a very petty man on that count, so he holds grudges. So this isn't just about Trump's vision of the world. This is personal.
How did you find, Scott, the situation in with the USAID and the way that they're talking about? Because Elon Musk is saying that it's related to the left, far left, their agenda and the sort. Is that far left? Is that globalist behind this sort of organization? Who's behind this? And what was the agenda that Donald Trump and his administration are not agreeing on?
Well, the rules-based international order is a bipartisan agenda that's been in place since the end of World War II. Republicans and Democrats alike have furthered it. Donald Trump, again, in his campaign, called out the rules-based international order and said that requires America to interface with the world in a way that is inherently confrontational, that the greatest threat to America in the world today is America. the rules-based international order. The rules-based international order requires the United States to seek to shape the world as the United States needs the world to be so that we can best exploit the world. And that was the mission of USAID. To go in, it's to use soft power, so you gain access on the subterfuge of trying to help people. And then you get in there, and through various programs, you seek to change societies, to change regimes, to shape the world the way you want it. The USAID has been doing this forever. In the 1980s, the USAID got a new outlet, the National Endowment for Democracy, that had a lot of regime change built into it. But remember, USAID was created in 1961. Do you know the name John Paul Vaughan? Are you familiar with him? Neil Sheehan wrote a book called A Bright Shining Lie. It's the story of John Paul Vaughan, an Army officer who then got involved in Vietnam, called out all the problems of Vietnam, but then went back as the USAID chief. And anybody who says, well, USAID is about foreign aid and helping, he was a civilian commander of American military forces in the war. He was the head of something called CORDS, which brought together USAID, U.S. Information, Department of Defense, Department of State, the CIA. His program, CORDS, ran the Phoenix assassination programs. That's a USAID program. That's 1970, 1971, 72. So a decade after being created, USAID is in the war-fighting business, the regime sustainment business, covert operations, assassinations. It's been doing this in Africa. It's been doing this in Latin America, South America. Everywhere USAID is, these are the programs that they run. They have different cutouts. And the other thing that happens is that USAID, when they created the National Endowment for Democracy and these other congressionally mandated programs, you've now not just politicized the activities, but you've done it in a bipartisan fashion. For instance, National Endowment for Democracy then has four operating arms. One of them is a Republican Institute, one's a Democratic Institute, one is a labor institute. I can't remember what the fourth one is, but they all are political constituencies. And what happens is that they each get these lobbyists now who start to lobby for different policies. So Washington, D.C. is full of offices of these lobbyists who work with Congress. People should go look up the Helsinki Commission. It's a congressional body that gets together and plans regime change operations and under the guise of spreading democracy. But these people have meetings where they plot things, then they establish programs, they define the funding for the programs, and the money, Congress allocates the money to USAID, who then farms it out and sends it off there. And it's not just American groups. We work with the German Marshall Fund. It's more American than German, I'll tell you that. The European Endowment for Democracy, there ain't nothing European about that. It's run, America directs that. The Norwegian Refugee Council. Now, there's a big one, the NRC. Those boys have been around there helping the world. They're everywhere, and they're Norwegians, so they can be trusted. But the Norwegian Refugee Council has an arm called the Norwegian Refugee Council USA, and it lives in Washington, D.C., and it meets with Congress to get the money. The NRC, Norwegian Refugee Council, was given $154 million in miscellaneous discretionary cash. What do you use $154 million for in miscellaneous discretionary cash? I think you put it in duffel bags and you throw it into the cars of corrupt Ukrainian officials. That's how you buy off things. This is as corrupt as $154 million in discretionary cash. That's not even the money that, if you take a look at the pay that these NRC people get, they're extraordinarily well paid. And the people that are running their offices, they get big fat paychecks. So a lot of money gets put out there. And then as it works its way down the system, it's just going into different people's pockets, making everybody happy. You know how you do corruption in Washington, D.C.? One of the main ways, let's say you're a senator and you come up, Scott, I'd like your support. I'm going to write you a nice check, Senator Al-Khashid. I'm going to give you a nice big old check. Well, what do you, I don't need anything, man. You just, you do the right thing there, Senator. You're a good man. I know you're a good man. And then you become Senator, and then you call up Scott. Yep. Scott, you're a great American. Well, I thank you, Mr. Senator. Scott, I think you'd be perfect to head up the Save the Rwandan Whales. There are no whales in Rwanda, but we're going to Save the Rwandan Whales program because it's a program that just a great American like you can do. Well, gosh, Senator, thank you for thinking of me when you're thinking of the Rwandan Whales. It's always been a program near and dear to my heart. Yep, so we're going to give that to you, and you know, you got to, you can build up a staff and all that. We expect good things from you. And I come in, I sit down at my desk, and I get a nice big check, a couple hundred thousand dollars, maybe a couple million. And then I hire all my little cronies who get lots of money too. And if there ever was a Rwandan whale, it's not going to get anything except maybe a visit by someone who goes, look, photo opportunity, Rwandan whale saving. That's it. That's how USAID works. I know Samantha Power can sit there and cry about, you know, peanut butter paste and it's not getting in the mouths of the little South Sudanese refugees. Yes, but you know what, Samantha? That's the most expensive frickin' paste in the world. If you really wanted to get paste into the hands of them, you'd mass produce that by the billions, you cut out all the middleman, and you just parachute it in. But nope, you go through the whole USAID thing because it's not about paste. And she knows that. It's about creating a front that allows you to infiltrate people in on the ground who are doing regime change, regime sustainment, intelligence collection. USAID is a CIA front. That's just the way it is. That's the reality of the world. And I've been calling it out from the get-go, and it's personal for me because USAID is responsible for destroying my wife's country, or trying to destroy my wife's country of Georgia, undermining it, trying to, you know, make it something that isn't. And fortunately, the Georgian government has been able to prevent that from happening. But USAID is a horrible organization, and I'm thrilled to death that they're going away. Thrilled to death. And now what you're going to find is that same pattern exists in every single major government department out there. Department of Education, why do you think everybody's scared to death of the Department of Education getting looked at? Because it is the most corrupt place on the planet. It's not about educating the American people. It's about making money for people, setting up sinecures, helping unions, the teachers' union do things that have nothing to do with education, but everything to do about political empowerment. You know, the last thing on the Department of Education's mind is, can little Bobby and Julie, you know, do their math and do their English? You know, first of all, it's not a federal problem. Ask yourself again. I mean, the last time I looked, it's the town of Bethlehem has a school board that makes decisions about the town of Bethlehem school. The state can come in and get involved in that, but why the hell is the federal government getting involved in a local education issue? And how much money does it cost to have a federal government person who will never get any money? I mean, this is corruption on a scale that you haven't imagined, and it's going to be disconcerting to people who thought that the Department of Education was about education. It's not about education. None of these departments are about what they say they're about. They're all about making money for people. It's the biggest money laundering scheme out there, and Donald Trump's finally bringing it to bear, and we need to. Why do you think we're $36 trillion in debt? Because we just, this is waste and fraud. I mean, you can't run a country this way. It's not sustainable. And this is what, I love it. There's no such thing as the deep state. I just defined to you the deep state. I just told you what the deep state is. It's this permanent bureaucracy that has hijacked America. We talked about the parasite-host relationship. This permanent bureaucracy is a parasitic element attached to the American people, sucking the life out of us. And we're not even aware of it. We're not even allowed to ask the question. My God, the second you say deep state, you're a conspiracy theorist. No, it's real. It's there. It's being exposed. And the powers that be, especially the Democrats, are scared to death of what's happening. Kicking and screaming and moaning and this. Donald Trump promised a revolution. We got one, baby. And I've never been happier in my entire life. I understand there's people losing their jobs. I understand that it's problematic. But if you were in a job that wasn't a job, if you're just a placeholder to sustain a system that wasn't accomplishing anything, moving papers from one desk to another that never solved an issue. I mean, take the LA mayor. Well, we'll eventually allow you to your home sites to clean it, but it's going to take a week of us moving paper from one desk to another. No, it could happen right now, mayor. Just come in and go home. Why do I have to pay people to shuffle papers around? This is what's happened in America today. We've become way overregulated, way overcontrolled by a bureaucracy that doesn't care about the people at all. It only cares about sustaining the bureaucracy and empowering Congress, the power of the purse. I think Congress is scared to death that the American people figure out how things really work. To give you an example, how many people in Congress actually read funding bills? None. Just the bigwigs. The bigwigs are aware of the things, but all the bigwigs do are they're told, okay, this is the USAID sustainment package. You remember, we went over that 15 years ago, Senator, when you first came in, sustainment package, you don't need to look at it now. We've thrown a couple little things here. We took care of your people, though. You know, your guys down there, you're good. We gave you 15 more slots. Remember, you asked us for 15 more slots so you could get some of your people that are donors in there. We took care of that. Nobody reads it. It's just there. And what happens in that is that the people that run USAID, they're not accountable to anybody. So when the odd representative says, I'm concerned, I want to go and look at it, and they go, hey, we want to come out and visit. We don't want you to come out and visit, but we're coming out and visit. Okay, take them on a car, show them the park, show them this, get them the hell out of the country. We are not responsive to Congress. Even when you get a political appointee, a director comes in and says, hey, I want this and the other thing. The people go, no, we don't work for you. I'm the director. Yeah, you're a political appointee. Okay. USAID is about the sustainment package that was approved by Congress 15 years ago when we worked it over. And that's all about. I just have to wait you out. You're nothing. And so it's on its own. There's no oversight. It just is happening on its own. All departments, all agencies are that way. The CIA is the most dangerous one. These guys are out there doing regime change. They're murdering people. They're destroying the economies of the world. They're on full automatic. And they don't report to anybody. You know, Gina Haspel was the director of the CIA, old-time operative. And she came in, and at that time, Obama was like, hey, a little worried about this, what's going on in Russia. So she went down to the Russian Mission Center and said, let's work. And they went, pound sand, we're the Russian Mission Center. We've been doing Russia stuff since before you were born. And we're not responsive to you. We're not talking to you. We just do what we do. Well, I'd like to review your intelligence, how you handle. No, ma'am, you don't get anywhere near how we handle our agents and all this kind of stuff. That's it. The CIA is full of fiefdoms. Near East Division, full of a bunch of guys who grew up assassinating, Iraqis, overthrowing Arab regimes, blowing up places in Persia, the secret war in Afghanistan. These guys aren't responsive to anybody. Latin America is just an old boy network. Africa, they don't respond to anybody. The CIA is an agency 100% out of control, 100% from the operational perspective, and it needs to be eliminated straight up. You bring them all in and fire them. And some of these guys are so dangerous, you might have to put them in Guantanamo because that's how dangerous these people are. They're so off the reservation, it's not even funny. FBI. The FBI is full of power-hungry assholes who basically wake up in the morning and say, which American can I screw today? That's it. Who are we going to screw today? They came after me because they're unhappy with what I'm saying. Well, Pam Bondi just undid that. I don't know if you're aware of the Attorney General's letter that she wrote saying cease and desist on the FARA prosecutions. If they have a problem with me, give me the frickin' letter like you're supposed to that says this is the problem and give you an opportunity to fix it. They never gave me the letter. They just came in and raided my house because it's not about me doing anything wrong. It's about them trying to intimidate me. That's what the FBI is in the business to do, to intimidate people. That's the wrong business, man, not in America. And so that's being undone. This is a revolution, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's chaotic. And I think you're going to see this revolution going over into national security and foreign policy. It's going to get ugly, really ugly. But I think Trump is trying to streamline things and simplify things and get America out of the business of being the world's policeman, out of the business of sustaining this rules-based international order. You know, he's going to try and replace it with something very simple, America first. Well, at least that's more honest than the rules-based international order, which pretended that it was about the world getting together to live in accordance with rules, but the rules are all written by America. You know, at least Trump is honest enough to say, we're not playing the World Trade Organization game anymore. We're not playing the World Health Organization game. We're not playing these games anymore. We're just straight up telling you, it's my way or the highway. Is that going to work? I don't know. Probably not. But at least it's more honest than anything we've done in the past. And I'm thrilled to death at this revolution, especially the domestic one. America was fundamentally broken. We were going to hell in a handbasket. And that's what people need to understand. As ugly as it's going to get, that's the only way you save America, because we were dying. We had a parasite on us. This deep state was sucking the life out of us, creating unsustainable, economic, risk, the debt bubble. Can Trump fix it? I don't know. But the only way you can fix it is to have a revolution where you literally reset America. And that's what we're in the process of doing, or at least trying to do. And I think it's wonderful. And the fact that the Democrats are going bananas and the old school Republicans are going bananas tells you it's working, because they're watching everything they thought was there that sustained them and sustained the power structures that they represent get flushed down. It's gone. And Trump's building something new.
When you look at the organizations and the people who receive the funds from USAID, you see political mainstream media, you see George Soros receiving money from this organization. Well, in your opinion, why do they need to pay George Soros? We know he's one of the main donors of many NGOs around the world, and he's feeding them. But why does he need to receive money from USAID? He knows the channels better than them. That's why they're sending money to George Soros. Then he gives it to other, I don't know, NGOs that they're not familiar with USAID.
Got to ask George Soros this. I mean, who am I to sit here and talk for George Soros or USAID? I will say this, that George Soros foundations and his Open Society program has been a very effective front for regime change operations around the world. And everybody knew that it was a CIA operation. But, you know, the CIA is very clever. The way the CIA does soft power regime change is not to have a task force, you know, like, the Iraq Operations Group, IOG. That was a CIA thing run out of the Directorate of Operations to overthrow Saddam Hussein. But that was about paramilitary operations, classic CIA political action, covert operations. And the CIA is fully capable of doing that. But when they do soft power, and they apply soft power, the whole idea of the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy was to create a front for regime change operations that wasn't tainted by the CIA's presence. And so George Soros has this foundation. I can almost guarantee you, I can guarantee you, that somewhere locked away in a safe waiting to be discovered is the founding documentation of George Soros's Open Society group. And it's not the one that they're telling. It's the one that's in the CIA vault, where they sat down and said, okay, you're going to be setting this thing up. We're going to be, you know, using it. This is funding channels that we have, et cetera. And they did it. George Soros didn't bring about, you know, the Rose Revolution in Georgia, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine and all that. The CIA did. That's what they do. But they used George Soros, so it couldn't be said this is a CIA operation. But everybody knows it's CIA. The CIA, though, doesn't operate with the operations group. Basically, what happens is the State Department has a meeting, you know, on the seventh floor in conference room, you know, 71 Charlie, and everybody shows up there, and you got, you know, George Soros people, and you got the USAID people, and the National Endowment people, and the Republican Institute people, and the Democratic people, and they all sit there, and they start talking, and in the back, in the corner, is a guy that looks like Larry Johnson, and he's got a Hawaiian shirt, and he's got khaki shorts and sandals, and he's just sitting there flipping through something. He might even be stewing on a cigar that's not lit because you can't light them nowadays. And he's just listening and taking notes and maybe listening to some music and rocking out. And every once in a while, he goes, hey, no, we're not going to do that. You're going to, that's going over here. That's going over there. You guys got that? Okay, yeah. Go back. Because he's directing the whole show. Because he's the one who knows where the money has to go. He's the one who knows the people that need to be empowered. He, you know, he's the orchestra. He's the conductor, but he's not going to be up there, you know, conducting. He's just going to be sitting back there monitoring and then when it's all done and he leaves, his name's not on the roster. It's going to have all the people that attended that meeting. His name ain't on the roster. I've been to meetings like that, not USAID meetings, but I've been to the State Department on the seventh floor carrying out those meetings. And there's the guy in the corner whose name never appears on the roster because he's from the Central Frickin' Intelligence Agency in a role that they don't want to acknowledge. That's just the way Washington, D.C. works. The CIA does attend. There's people coming in. I'm from the CIA. You know, it's funny. I've been to those meetings too. And one meeting, you know, hi, my name is Harry Reid. Oh, pleasure to meet you, Harry Reid. Da, 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 da. And then 6 months later, we're at a meeting, same guy. Yeah, my name is Lloyd Smith. But weren't you Harry Reid last time I met you? Don't worry about that. Gotcha. I mean, so this stupidity, they're not even that good at what they do anymore. But I'm just trying to say that the CIA has been running this thing. You got to realize what Soros is. It's a CIA front. You got to realize all the CIA, when people say, you know, the CIA, they're everywhere. They're everywhere and they have to be disbanded. I mean, I used to go to these meetings back in when I was a weapon in the, when I was doing the INF treaty in the opening moments of it, I was put in charge of counterintelligence as a frickin' lieutenant. I was just supposed to sit at a desk and answer phones. But then the FBI deputy director, very senior guy, and the colonel, Air Force colonel, who was his deputy, they were gone because we were forming an agency. They had to go back to the FBI and the Air Force and do things. So I'm just sitting there at the desk and ring, ring, ring. Hello? Yeah, this is a Special Agent Smith. With the National Security Agency. And we've got a meeting right now to talk about how we're going to do X, Y, and Z and all that. And we need the on-site inspector representative. That would be me. So I'd go to the meeting. And I'd go to these meetings and, but when I'm there, there's just people around the table. And they start handing me business cards. Oh, good talking to you, Scott. We'll be in touch. And I look at the business card. And a lot of them were, you know, INSCOM or NSA or, you know, DIA or, you know, FBI. You go, okay, I know this. No. J. Smith Export-Import. Well, who the hell is J? Why is an export-import company here? What's going on? And the more meaning, then this guy would just show up at everything. I realized he's not in the export-import business. He's doing something completely different. And that's just a cover. And that's, I have a stack of business cards like this. Probably the FBI, I don't have to check. Maybe the FBI took them when they raided my house. Maybe that's why they raided my house. But, you know, the point is, there's a whole way America runs that nobody's aware of. The whole way the intelligence community, and they don't do anything good. That's the other thing I want to put up there. You know, the big thing, this is a true story. The Soviets came to Magda, Utah, and they start buying VHS players. You know, that's big back in the late 1980s, VHS. And they're like, we're going to get this and bring it home. And so they're all going out and buying VHS. And, of course, they got a list. They, you know, the colonel needs one of this. So they're buying a whole bunch of them. And suddenly there's an emergency meeting that I have to attend. And they're like, all right, why are the Soviets buying VHS? You know, if they stack them up, they wire them all together, they can get each one to collect against a very specific frequency, and they could try to intercept this, because in Salt Lake City, we have a confluence of communication systems, boom, boom, boom. And there he is, John Smith from J&S Export-Import Company, leading the charge. And I'm like, why is an export-import guy sitting here talking about the Soviets stacking VHS decks in their basement intercepting American microwave communications. And I said, because one of the, I was there as counterintelligence, but I was also there because we had Americans in Vodkinsk. And if you do anything against the Soviets in Utah, there's repercussions because it's called reciprocity. So I have a vested interest in saying, don't screw with them too much, because what goes around comes around for people like me over there, who we're in the middle of nowhere and we have, you know, very little latitude to have fun over there on our off time. And if you screw with them, they're going to screw with us. But then the other thing I was like, and I asked the question, what if they're just buying VHS decks? What do you mean? What if they just want to bring a VHS player home? Is it against the law? No. Then why are we making a big deal out of this? So what we ended up doing, the common sense solution was, when you buy a VHS deck, you can either get it so that it's part of your, that you're using it in your housing, or it just goes into storage until you fly back to the Soviet Union, then we bring it all out and give it to you. And that was the solution. But in the meantime, the export-import company was out there running. They're everywhere, Nima. They're everywhere. The secret underworld of American intelligence. The FBI runs them. Every single, the DAA, DEA, they all have these covert, non-official cover things happening in America that are unaccountable to anybody. To anybody. And they do crazy shit. And that's not the way America's supposed to work. That's why I love what Pam Bondi just did. Everybody's so mad at her right now, because, you know, Adam Schiff and everybody, you know, because she shut down the malign influence joint task force, you know, that was saying that, you know, Russia's out to, that's the task force that came after me, because apparently I was working with the Russians to undermine the presidential election last year. So they came after me. They're the ones who came after me. And she shut it down. They're like, well, see, the Russians won. No, America won. Because that was a BS investigation to begin with, run by a bunch of people who don't know anything about Russia, whose sole purpose is just to empower themselves. When they create these task force, they very rarely solve the problem that they're meant to solve. What they do is create additional bureaucracies that then get staffed and funded with untold amounts of money that enrich people without ever solving the problem. Every time there's one of these task forces, and these are task forces that should be doing good things. But ask yourself why we don't win the war against drugs. Ask yourself why we don't stop child pornography. Ask yourself why we haven't made a dent in any of these things. It's because none of the programs set up are designed to actually solve the problem. They're designed as funding mechanisms to enrich people, and the USAID model, models repeat themselves. This is the point I'm trying to make. Models behavior, the government behavior with USAID is the same government mentality behavior that exists with everything the government does. Shut it down. Start over. And start over being honest and keep it simple and stay mission focused. What is your job? Your job is to do X. Do your job. That's it. You don't need a lot of people to make that thing happen. You don't have to create a bureaucracy. You don't have to create this, that, and the other thing. Repent. Get rid of it all and start over. And I hope that's what Donald Trump's doing, because if not, this country's screwed. It's unsustainable and it's un-American. Americans have to stay. And eventually, with the extent of how the government has deceived the American people becomes known, how Congress has deceived us, the blowback to Congress should be, you know, devastating. Almost everybody who's in Congress should be voted out. And it's time to get a new generation of people in who don't have to operate off of this corruption, this corrupt model. Because once you become in Congress, you get on committees. Ask yourself what they do in those committees. What's the purpose of the committee? It ain't solving problems. It's having meetings to create funding opportunities, to get budget opportunities. Why does our budget keep growing? And why don't we know where the money goes? Why is it acceptable that we can have $268 billion, just we don't know what happened to it? Overpayments. Overpayments! I remember when I was in the military, they overpaid me once. I did a TDY, and they overpaid me by like $58. You know, oh, for God's sake. I mean, they came to me, immediate repayment right now. Took it out of my pay, acted like I was the criminal. I didn't do it. It was your mistake, not my mistake. $268 billion in overpayments, and they're not even trying to get it back because it's not supposed to be gotten back, Nima. It's a deliberate corruption to enrich people, to empower people, and every single one of these politicians is involved in it. They are so filthy, dirty, corrupt. It's not even, that's why Donald Trump's a breath of fresh air. I know he grabs women by the pee, and I know he does this, and I know he's bad and all that stuff, but you know what he's not? A frickin' senator, a frickin' representative, a frickin' governor, or a frickin' state official. He's never been corrupted by that system. He's been corrupted by a different system. You know, but at least he's honest about it. I mean, you got to love the honesty of a man that sits there and says, I know how to play the tax game because I that's why I gave you money, Hillary. I gave you money so that you change the tax law so that I can do it. I know how this game works. He's been on the other end. So, you know, there we are. I mean, I am so thrilled that they're starting to target this because I've been calling it out. I've been aware of this corruption from day one. Early on, I wasn't aware of the scope and scale, just things that didn't make sense. Like, why am I meeting with an export-import guy when I'm talking about national counterintelligence? I don't know. I thought, you know, I was just a stupid little lieutenant going, I thought the world was, you know, very structured because the Marine Corps is very structured, but apparently it wasn't. I start asking questions. Then I start looking at, you know, larger issues, you know, in the arms control business, counterintelligence business. Then I got involved in Iraq. It was just a mind-blowing thing, the corruption there. And then once you come out, you know, you've seen all these patterns and you're able to take these templates and overlay them. And so it's like, you see that movie, it's when Ryan Reynolds, he's the computer, he's an animated guy for you, that guy or something like, but when he puts on the glasses, like he's looking into world, he's like, oh no, I got the glasses. And I'm sitting there going, oh no. And that's the thing. That's a lot of reason why I'm so angry is because I can see what the hell's going on and I'm trying to explain it to people. And it's hard to explain because it's just so outrageous. When I was trying to explain to my parents about the corruption of the weapons of mass destruction scam that was being run, you know, my dad was like, well, Rush Limbaugh believes that, you know, this, that, and I'm like, no. Well, then why doesn't the Washington Post agree with you? Because they're all in on it. Everybody's in on it. That's the whole thing. It's one giant scam, one giant grift. And I happen to be the guy that was in a position to put on the glasses and go, oh my God. But it's hard to explain that to people. Thank God for what Elon Musk is doing with USAID. Because now everybody's getting the glasses. And hopefully they're all doing the same thing, going, oh my God, wait till you get the glasses for the Department of Education. Wait till you get the glasses for the Department of Commerce and all these other corrupt entities. And you realize, wait till America finds out the truth about the national highway system and how it's funded and how we handle those contracts and who gets the contracts and how much the contracts cost to put highways. It's all a scam. It's all a scam.
Scott, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, we know that it seems that Keith Kellogg is going to present his proposal or the Donald Trump administration's proposal for the conflict in Ukraine. Do we know if he has changed the terms in the proposal that everybody was talking about?
I don't know. I don't know that. Do you know that? I don't think anybody knows that. I know the following. Vladimir Putin doesn't give a damn about anything Keith Kellogg's going to say because none of it matters. The Russians have made it clear this war ends the way Russia wants it to end. That's it. Nothing else matters. And anybody tries to do, I mean, the things that we're seeing, I mean, we see, you know, no NATO. Well, gee, thanks. Russia already said that. So who is the United States to give Russia that? Russia went to war because of that. You know, the reason why there's a war is because NATO wanted to get into Ukraine and Russia went, no. So for the United States to go, okay, no NATO, Russia, no, we're already there. There won't be a NATO. It's not your decision to make. We made that decision already. Non-negotiable. The territories, Crimea and Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk and Lugansk, it's Russia. Russia already made that decision. The war won't end until all of those territories belong to that and the Ukrainians are out of Kursk. Okay? It's non-negotiable. You're not going to freeze the thing. A ceasefire. There won't be a ceasefire. The only time the shooting stops is when a peace treaty is signed. There won't be a ceasefire before that, because otherwise Russia has yielded all the advantages that it's obtained by carrying out this very expensive war of attrition. They now have total control over the scope and scale and the pace in the direction of the battlefield. And it's all moving in Russia's direction. Why would Russia ever reverse that? And there won't be a single foreign soldier on Ukrainian soil unless they speak Russian and they wear the Russian uniform. There's not going to be British peacekeepers, French peacekeepers. There won't be any peacekeepers. Peacekeeping, by the way, only happens when both sides agree to this. So the idea of unilaterally imposing a peacekeeping solution on Russians that don't want it just means you'll have dead peacekeepers, because they won't be peacekeepers. They'll be war fighters fighting on behalf of Ukraine. This is the reality. Russia has prepared a plan, an economic plan, for sustainment of their defense industry and the economic investments into this war that goes through the end of 2027 into 2028. Budanov, the head of Ukrainian intelligence, says that Ukraine ceases to exist this summer. You tell me which model is the more sustainable model. Keith Kellogg, it doesn't matter what he thinks or what he says or does. It's irrelevant. It's a game being played for domestic consumptions. The Russians aren't listening. They don't care. And I wish Keith Kellogg would start listening to the Russians, because that's the reality. The United States has no leverage over Russia. Trump and Kellogg talk about bringing the oil down to $45 a barrel. Russia can laugh that off. You know who can't? The United States. Go to West Texas. Ask the Wildcatters, have been pouring all their life savings and everything, borrowing money from the bank to drill the new oil, drill baby drill. Those new wells break even point $66. Right now they're making money because it's $78. Drop it down to 45 and watch all of those barrels go, those wells go out of business. And watch all the wildcat companies go bankrupt, and watch the American economy collapse, and watch oil production in the United States drop by 30% in 2 years. That's the reality. You know, so Trump needs to, you know, they're just in fantasy land. But I think one of the things that Trump does is he puts forward, remember, I think we have to treat the Kellogg peace plan with the same skepticism that we treated Trump's Gaza peace plan. Absurd, unrealistic, is never going to happen. But it's the opening gambit. Remember, Trump is putting something out for not just the Russians, but the Ukrainians and NATO. He has to play those too. And I'm pretty sure at the end, the Russians are going to get what they want, because that's the only way this war ends. If Trump wants the war to end this year, then he has to fast track getting Russia to where it wants to be. If Trump causes a problem, Russia will get there on Russia's timetable. It'll cost the Ukrainians a lot more lives. It'll cost us, you know, more money, but it isn't going to alter the outcome. And all it does is further entrench Russia against the United States. I think Donald Trump understands that, you know, his ultimate goal is to have stability in the European theater of operations. You're not going to get stability by forcing Russia to continue this war to crush NATO, crush Europe, and embarrass the United States. The best way to avoid embarrassment is don't put yourself in embarrassing situations. And right now, trying to stand up to Russia on Ukraine is an embarrassment.
Do you think that Donald Trump, two options on his part, talking with Putin immediately or letting this conflict going on as long as Zelensky is willing to continue the conflict? And this is not the problem for Donald Trump. If Ukrainians, or maybe the administration in Ukraine, because we don't know what do Ukrainians feel about this situation in Ukraine, but at least the Zelensky administration wants to continue the conflict. And how is that going to, if you look at Donald Trump and his behavior, does he really want them, I'm talking about Zelensky and the government in Ukraine, to understand the situation they're in, and they asked Donald Trump to put an end to the conflict?
Again, why are you pretending Donald Trump can put an end to the conflict? Why is anybody pretending this? It's a pretense. Zelensky can ask Trump all he wants. Zelensky can demand of Trump. Zelensky can beg to Trump. Russia doesn't care. Donald Trump literally doesn't have a say in any of this. Trump believes he does. He's trying to make himself to be the big player. The biggest player in this is Vladimir Putin. That's the big dog. Trump is a big dog trying to get into the big dog's neighborhood. you know, the big dog's like, I don't want to fight with you, but you know, but you got to get rid of the barking chihuahuas, you know, and this is my neighborhood. But Trump does can't come in and say, oh, now you go back to your kennel and you go back to your kennel and it all belongs to me. Who the hell is Donald Trump to come walking in and say, we get all the rare earth metals in Ukraine? And the Russians are like, well, you're going to have to kick us off that land because we own it, pal. We're going to own it all and you're going to get none of it. None of it. This is the stupidity of the Trump approach. And it's so stupid that you have to take a step back and go, he knows it's stupid. Donald Trump's not an idiot. This is, again, I think part of the opening audacious gambit. But the difference is with the Middle East, he has multiple opportunities. I think Trump understands that he's got one shot with Putin. And he better make it a good one. And so this is why you haven't seen the phone call yet. This is why they haven't set up a meeting yet. And this is why instead of a 24-hour timetable, you're talking of, you know, 80 to 100 days. A lot can happen in 80 to 100 days, including the elimination of Zelensky as a political issue, which I think is the direction many people are heading, and the collapse of Ukraine's ability to sustain itself economically, politically, and militarily, which puts a whole new spin on the reality of negotiations. Right now, Ukraine is laboring under the false promise of American support and America will back them up. But when it becomes apparent that it's all over, as Budanov said, Ukraine ceases to exist. To give you an example of where the Russians are on this one, the head of the Russian intelligence service, an old friend of Vladimir Putin's, is holding meetings and within Russia and is talking about holding meetings with regional neighbors to carve up Ukraine in a post-conflict reality. I think part of denazification is to turn Western Ukraine, where the Ukrainian nationalists are, over to Poland and let the Poles solve the problem of the Banderists. And the Poles have no love lost with the Banderists, so here you have common cause. I think the Hungarians are very interested in the Hungarian population of Carpathia. I think the Slovakians are interested in the Ruthenians. And I think the Romanians have an interest in that too. So I think you have all these neighbors of Ukraine that are more than happy, I think, at the end to carve Ukraine up. And this is what Trump has to understand. That's the reality. That's the outcome. Trump's not going to stop that because this war ends when Russia wants it to end. And one of the ways it's going to end is with a total political collapse of the Ukrainian government. And then Russia steps in with its own version of it. They already have the guy they want to be, the interim president. They already have interim parliamentarians. This government that's there right now isn't going to exist. It's going to be eliminated. That's part of denazification. The Ukrainian military is going to be eliminated. That's demilitarization. It's not just no NATO. It's the fundamental change. And I think you're also going to look at Russia. Everybody's like, well, Russia's going to have to take Odessa and Kharkov. No, they don't. There's no articulation of that from Vladimir Putin, and Russia's not making any of the military steps that would be necessary to seize Odessa and Kharkov. What Russia is going to do is create the political conditions under which Russia will be able to assert its authority in a post-conflict manner in these areas by overseeing the governance of those regions and then create through economic investment, et cetera, the conditions that are favorable for a referendum 3 to 5 years down the road where those populations vote to join Russia and secede from Ukraine. That's how Russia gets Odessa. That's how Russia gets Kharkov. And maybe how they get Dnepropetrovsk and Mykolaiv as well. This is where Donald Trump could actually play a role and go into Russia and say, hey, we'll give you everything you want, but we need assurances that the post-conflict, that the territories that are there are going to be part of a greater Ukraine. We'll let you have a say on how a greater Ukraine looks, but you need to commit to a treaty that has a clause that says no referendums, that there won't be a pathway to referendum, a pathway to independence. That way, post-war Ukraine has Odessa, has access to the Black Sea, has economic viability. They have Dnepropetrovsk. They have, you know, Kharkov. They have the minerals that are there. There's, you know, a potential for a post-war economy that's beyond agronomy. That's what Trump could be doing if he was smart. But instead, he's, and maybe that's the direction he's going. But to get there, I think it's the same thing with anything. You've got to get everybody to recognize that the path that people were headed on, because the concept of a ceasefire and foreign peacekeepers, that predates Donald Trump. That's a concept that was being bandied around under Biden. Trump can't just ignore all that and jump over here, because people will say, oh, no, you've caved into Putin, you've caved into Russia. So he goes in with this, and it becomes totally impractical, but it begins a process of negotiation where the Russian reality is gradually able to be absorbed. And in the end, you get some sort of compromise. And I do think the one area that the Russians would be willing to compromise on is a guarantee, because I talked to the former prime minister of Ukraine, who has fled to Russia as part of the Ukrainian government in exile. And he said, a Ukraine without Odessa, a Ukraine without Kharkiv is not a Ukraine. It's not economically viable. And so it's in the interest of Ukraine to have both those territories stay in Ukraine, and it's in the interest of Russia to have them stay in there, because long-term, saying no to NATO is one thing. You know, and the other thing Trump is saying, you know, guaranteed EU membership. No, that's not going to happen. Ukraine is going to become part of the union. That right now there's, you know, you have Belarus and Russia have an economic political union. Ukraine's going to become a part of that, a three-way union. That's the future of Ukraine, a three-way union that ties it to Russia, because Russia's never again going to allow Ukraine to be used by the West as a tool to undermine Russia. That will never again happen. It's not just about kicking NATO out. It's about ensuring Ukraine stays in the Russian orbit forever in perpetuity. That's it. And that's a reality that the United States has to accept and NATO has to accept. If they don't want to, then they, you know, this war will go on until Russia dictates that outcome. But Ukraine will not be an independent state leaning towards the West ever again. Russia can't afford that. They're not going to fight this war 30 years from now, which would be what happens if you allow Ukraine to be polluted by the West, to become a member of the European Union. First of all, the European Union is not going to be here in 30 years anyway, so it doesn't matter. But no, Russia is going to insist that Ukraine is part of an economic and political union. And that way, Odessa and Kharkiv, the economic potential benefits not just Ukraine, but also the Union as a whole. And that's how Russia controls those areas. And that's how the people who live there, who are speaking Russian and ethnic Russians, feel safe and secure in there, because that'll be built into the Constitution. And because it's a union, there's open borders. They can travel freely into Novorossiya. They can travel freely into Russia. And that's the direction we're heading. They're going to jettison Western Ukraine, though. I don't think the Russians want anything to do with Lvov and that, because it's full of poisonous people. And that's Poland's problem. Poland's going to have to deal with those people.
Scott Kasia Kellos, she said, announced that the Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia will be completely disconnected from Russian energy grid tomorrow.
Okay.
Who's going to give them energy?
I don't care. They're not my problem. I literally don't wake up in the morning and go, oh my God, what's happening in the Baltics? Lithuania has spoken. Holy cow. Estonia is awakened. Oh my God. You know, God help us if, was it Latvia? Because the Latvians used to have some good riflemen. If you remember the Russian Revolution, the initial, lead elements of the Red Army were the Latvian riflemen. So my God, if the Latvians ever decide to become riflemen again, we're in trouble. It's over. No one cares. These people seize the headlines. They say stupid things. It doesn't matter. What they're going to find out is the following. Germany right now is waking up. Denmark's waking up to the fact that they need cheap Russian gas. America blew up the Nord Stream pipelines, and Europe's finally waking up saying, we got to fix it. Why? If you're so against Russian energy, if you're passing these sanctions, why are you fixing a pipeline that connects you to Russian gas? Because they know what the reality is, that Europe is collapsing and will continue to collapse until they get access to cheap energy. And they are also preparing for a future when there can be normalized relations. And when that happens, when Russian gas flows into Germany, the Baltics are going to be isolated, because no one's coming to their assistance. And Poland's going to be stuck. And you think the Poles, given a choice of you know, tying in economically with Germany and France and the rest, or, you know, hanging out with the yapping Chihuahuas. And I have a Chihuahua who I love to death, and so I don't like to make fun of them, or Pomeranians, but these are little dogs who are meaningless, the Baltic states. They're useless. And they're going to find themselves all alone, all alone. And like Finland, Finland's going to find itself very lonely. The Swedes always had a good Nordic relationship, but the Finns are going to find themselves very lonely with that big border with Russia that they suddenly tried to militarize, and they bankrupted themselves, and NATO is not going to exist in 5 years, and Finland's going to be sitting there going, what the hell did we do? And Russia's going to be like, you caused this problem, not us. And then Russia's going to dictate specific terms of how to re-engage. And I think the Baltics are going to find themselves in a position where they're going to have to learn to live with Russia. Let them play their stupid games right now. You think Russia's losing the sleep because, you know, Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia decide they're going to cut themselves off from Russian electricity? Russia could give a damn. Do it. Do it. But don't come complaining. Don't come knocking, begging down the road when everything you think is going to happen, the European Union and NATO, when it's all gone, it all falls apart, and you'll be all alone in our neighborhood. And you're going to look to us and say, can you help us? And Russia will, but they'll dictate some terms that aren't going to be, that the Baltics aren't going to like those terms.
I wonder what would Donald Trump say to them right after any sort of negotiation or peace treaty between the two parties. And who's going to take the pieces? Is that going to be the British government, Germany? Because I don't see Donald Trump being interested in rebuilding Ukraine. But on the
this Ukraine will be rebuilt at the direction of Russia.
Who's going to pay for it? This is the problem.
Not a problem. Why is it a problem?
Who's going to pay for it?
Ukraine.
On the part of Europeans.
Ukraine. Ukraine's going to pay for it. What is Donald Trump talking about? How many trillions of dollars of mineral wealth is under the Ukrainian soil right now? Okay, that's how Ukraine pays for it. Long term, China comes in. China will exploit those. Russia will exploit those. Russia's not about to. You know, people tend to forget. You got to learn your history. Do you remember the long telegram written by George Kennan, 1946, 1947 time period? It became sort of the foundation of containment. You know, we use it for containment. But what was it really written about? It was about the Russians, the Soviets, rejecting an effort of the West to come in and control the Russian economy. There were certain demands they're trying to place. They wanted the Russians to make concessions. The Russians said no. We're not letting you come into our economy. The Russians could have used help. I mean, hell, the Nazis came in, blew everything up. And so from the Western perspective, it's like, well, who's going to help the Soviet Union rebuild? The Soviet Union was destroyed a hell of a lot more than Ukraine has been. Ukraine doesn't realize it, but there hasn't been a war. This isn't a war. There's a lot of fighting taking place on the front line. Those villages are destroyed in a god-awful way. Kiev still stands intact. And almost every, you know, Ukrainian city is virtually untouched compared to what we saw in World War II, where entire things. The United States was in the business of rebuilding Europe, the Marshall Plan and all that. Who paid for the reconstruction of the Soviet Union? You know the answer. The Soviet Union did. They did what needed to be done. Who's going to pay for the reconstruction of Ukraine? Russia and Ukraine will. They don't need any help. These are people with a history of doing this very thing. They're not pathetic. They're not like the West. They're not helpless. When the Ukrainians get rid of the Banderists, get rid of the nationalists, and go back to their roots, you'll see that they will dig in and they will do what needs to be done to rebuild. And they'll do that with the assistance of the Russians and the assistance of BRICS, of Eurasia. That's the direction Russia has gone. Russia is not going to turn to the West for help. Russia just fought a war to keep the West the hell out of Ukraine. So Russia is not going to turn around and go, hey, let's bring in USAID. Yeah, George Soros, come on in, pal. Help us rebuild Ukraine, you bastard. No, Russia's not looking for help or a handout. Russia doesn't need it. Russia doesn't want it. Ukraine doesn't need it. Ukraine doesn't want it. They'll rebuild Ukraine the way it needs to be rebuilt. And this is actually a good opportunity for Russia and Ukraine to redefine an economic. Remember, Ukraine became independent at the most inconvenient time because every aspect of Ukraine's economy was geared towards supporting the Soviet Union, not supporting Ukraine. And so, you know, by rebuilding Ukraine, you're going to be redefining these economic relations on a more modern, healthier basis. And again, you have the Belarusian model. You know, Belarusian defense industry is totally integrated in with the Russian defense industry. And Ukraine has a very viable defense industry. The irony is that Dnipropetrovsk Dnipro factory could end up building a Russian-nik missiles, you know, the missile that hit it. So who knows what the future holds. But no, the West isn't going to have a say in this. Donald Trump has no interest. The United States will have no interest in Ukraine's mineral wealth. Russia isn't going to let it happen. And Russia gets to dictate the outcome because they won.
That's for sure. Yeah. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thanks for having me. I know it went on a little longer, but, you know, what the hell? You pulled my string and you got me to speak. So, all right.
Take care.
Have a good day.